Hello there, I'm Miranda Gretton, and this is Take a Moment with NCHC, the show where we talk to you and your colleagues about experiences that affect you. Listen on your drive between patients or in your downtime, whenever you get the chance to take a moment.
My name's Adam Peel. I'm a research nurse. I'm based with the community research team here at NCHC, and physically we're at West Pottergate Medical Centre. My post is funded by the NIHR, which is the National Institute for Health and Care Research. The community team remit is to deliver research within NCHC.
Okay, so when you say research, this might be a really stupid question. What kind of things are you researching?
So the community research team are doing they've got a few different projects going at the moment. Nice kind of straightforward one is looking at an electrical stimulation device to promote wound healing. Essentially, it stimulates the nerve, which stimulates muscle contraction, which promotes blood flow. So it increases perfusion of the tissues in that area, and well-perfused tissues should heal better. So they're doing some work with the leg ulcer clinic and the nurses there to see if wearing these devices will speed the healing of leg ulcers and so forth. So anything that can either speed the healing or promote healing in ulcers that wouldn't otherwise heal is a massive benefit, both to the patients in terms of their quality of life, also to the health service in terms of reducing demand if you can get these patients well and no longer needing our support. So yeah, it's recruiting patients into the study with the help and support of the nurses in the clinic, supplying these devices, measuring the size of the ulcer, seeing how rapidly they improve or not. Once you have sufficient participants in the study, you should be able to see if it does make a statistically significant difference in healing rates. I'm sat with the community research team who deliver research for the community trust, but I'm actually part of a different team. There's just two of us, my colleague and I, Beth, and we're part of the Agile team. And our role is to deliver research in the wider caring community. So when I'm talking to people within the NHS, I tend to just refer to them as non-NHS settings because it's a bit easier to explain it that way. So it's any care environment, really, health or social care. So it can be care homes, prisons, schools, any kind of care situation outside of the NHS. So at the moment, we're mainly focusing on care homes. And one of the bigger studies we're doing is called AFRICI. It's to do with air filters in care homes. So we know that using HEPA air filters in a controlled environment, such as an operating theatre, is a good thing, drives down infection rates and transmission and so forth. So the theory is that it should work in other settings as well. But care homes, you've got a vulnerable population, you've got lots of staff coming in and out, you've got visitors coming in and out, you've got large communal areas as well as smaller personal areas. So we don't know for sure whether putting air filters into care homes will actually have any real life impact on infection rates. So the AFRICI study is recruiting whole care homes across the country. Half of them will be receiving usual care, so the normal infection control kind of measures, and the other half will be having air filters into residence rooms and communal areas and staff areas. And then throughout the winter period, they're capturing data on respiratory symptoms, antibiotic prescriptions, any diagnoses of respiratory conditions. And that's running for several winters in order to get enough data to show whether these have a significant impact or not. But again, that's quite a complex study to design, and recruiting care homes and training up staff and getting these filters in and capturing the data is a huge undertaking. The concept of the study is really nice and straightforward, and I think a lot of the best studies are, you know, we'll put these in and we'll compare it with homes that don't have them and we'll see if it does reduce infection rates.
So what happens if you get to the end of the study and you discover that actually these filters haven't made any difference? Or do you find that you always get some useful data out of a study, even if it wasn't what you kind of went in for?
Classically, positive results where you've discovered something good, it's easy to get them published in higher impact journals. And if you're working within academia, that's And one of the kind of main criteria for success, getting your work into a big famous journal. But in terms of how academics and institutions are judged, they're trying to move away from that kind of paradigm of academic success and trying to show real life impact. So that the metrics they're using to measure success are getting broader, and you need to show that your research has made a difference to people's lives and to people's health. So in terms of negative results, it'd be really useful because you can tell care homes in a really straightforward way, you shouldn't go and shell out loads of money on these filters, because then, you know, they might reassure people, but they're not actually going to protect anybody.
Do people have to take part in the study? Or do you, you know, when you said about recruiting the care homes and you've got loads of them, because obviously you've got to do that comparison, do you find that people are generally quite up for being involved in research, or do sometimes people push back and say they don't want to be involved? And what do you do if that happens?
Oh, so this is an absolutely fascinating area. So research is really tightly regulated. So we all have to do lots of training on the seeking and receiving of informed consent. So the trust has got clear policies on this, and the research team that you're working with will have a protocol for their study, and they'll have really clear guidelines as well. They will have had to present that protocol at an NHS Research and Ethics Committee, which will be staffed with clinicians, but also members of the public and lay people who will look at any ethical issues associated with that project. So it will have gone through all of these hoops to make sure that it is okay. And then when we come to seek consent from potential participants, firstly, we need to make sure that they've understood what's involved by signing up. And before we then go through a consent form, and that's got all the kind of small print, the terms and conditions almost on there. But this is where it gets really interesting, is that if you only ever recruit people who it's really straightforward, they clearly understand, not a problem, then you are only going to get kind of well-educated, literate research participants, and you are going to exclude a huge swathe of the population. So this includes people with cognitive impairments, people with dementia, people with learning disabilities, all sorts of groups who we know may have some difficulty in accessing and getting the best from the health service. We know that we need to make it easier for these people to engage with and access services and research. So a very poor way of doing that is to, first of all, exclude them from all research. So certainly in care homes, particularly dementia specialist care homes, you've got some tricky decisions to make. So first of all, you would seek the input from the staff in those institutions to get their input, and they'll know the resident well and may have known them for years. So you'd seek their input. You would have a chat to the resident and try and gauge that yourself as well. And there are some options open to us. If after going through that process, we make a judgment that they lack the capacity to make this decision, we need to ask a few questions. Is it a temporary thing? Is it because they have a urinary tract infection? Is it because we've caught them on a bad day? Is it because we haven't given them what they need in terms of, you know, some information in an easy read format? Do we need to offer them further support? But if we've done everything we can to try and allow them to make their own decision, but we determine that they don't have that ability, then it depends on the study and what they've put in place and what the ethics committee have decided is appropriate. But sometimes we can seek a personal consultee. So that's a family member or friend, somebody who knows the resident well. They're not legally able to offer consent on behalf of that resident because they don't have that power. But if they know them well, they can let us know what they think the resident would want or would have wanted. So that is an option for us with some studies as well. But it is complicated, and you want to do your best. You want to be inclusive, but you're also very cognizant of the fact that there are strict guidelines in place, and there's a good reason for those guidelines to be there. So it is tricky.
what's the importance of research as a whole to the NHS and to our sort of communities in Norfolk and Waveney?
My colleague Donna uses a nice analogy. I'm sure she won't mind me pinching this, but I should credit her for it. But she uses the analogy of a bus, with the NHS being the bus and research being the headlights showing the way. And I was thinking about this before coming on here to chat to you. This is probably labouring the point unnecessarily, but the bus is funded by public money. So the public are paying for the diesel to go in that bus, and we want the bus to go on the most direct route possible. We want it to get as far as it can with as many people on board as it can. So research is both the headlights and the sat-nav. It's showing us where to go, how to get there in the most efficient way. So, I mean, the pandemic has provided, you know, great examples of what the NHS can do, what the NIHR can do, and what trusts can do in terms of delivering research that has huge impact on us all. So both in terms of personal health, but also in terms of demand on the health service and keeping people well and so forth. So yeah, it's impossible to overstate the potential impact of research. Kind of drilling down into the nitty-gritty, there's all sorts of research which will form parts of the guidelines for best care for individual kind of diseases and conditions and best practice. So even if it's not a research study, that is being done in our community trust and with our patients, it'll be feeding into guidelines that will have an impact on us and an impact on our staff. And research runs the big wide range from some of the stuff we talked about in terms of, does this gadget help to heal ulcers faster, to things like, how's the best way to deliver care? How's the best way to organise this? So some of the research that I've been kind of peripherally involved with out in the wider caring community, in the non-NHS settings, some of that was looking at transfers of care between acute trusts, between community communication with non-NHS settings like care homes. So some of those things are key. And certainly that's something you see in the headlines time and time again about, you know, how we can get the NHS integrated with social care. So, you know, some of those research projects looking at communication and linking networks together, linking systems together, is equally important and equally likely to impact on us.
It's one of those things that people won't know about or think about unless they're involved in some way, either in a study or having dealings with your team and your colleagues. Is there a research arm of every trust? Is it something that everyone is looking at, and then you link up with other areas so you can share best practice and knowledge and results, so that we can maybe learn from other areas and other trusts and other hospitals?
Yeah, and I'd say I've been in post for a year now, and I'm still just kind of getting to grips with how it all works, because it is very complicated. But the NIHR, if not decades and decades old, and the NIHR was set up to try and make this happen so that research is a nationwide thing, it's more collaborative and it's networked. So from my work, a nice example is the Enrich scheme. So it's an acronym, it stands for Enabling Research in Care Homes, and the NIHR has tried to engage with care homes up and down the country and get them onto this network. They get paid a very small amount of money just to kind of cover their time for the manager to have a look at some of the materials we're sending through and so forth. But it's just a way of care homes kind of putting their hand up and saying, yeah, we're open to the idea of conducting research here at our site. And it means that if you've got an academic team at the University of Bristol who wants to do some research in care homes, they don't have to go out from scratch and find care homes who are interested and convince them. They can come to the NIHR, they can say, this is the study we're doing, these are the approvals we've got, we can bring them on board, and then we can use our network of research nurses up and down the country and network of care homes to promote this study. And so that's the reason for the NIHR, one of the reasons for the NIHR. And they have got research nurses hosted by NHS trusts up and down the country. So there'll be acute hospital trusts, there'll be community trusts. Then they've also got these teams that are focused on primary care to deliver research in the GP setting. And then we're the latest addition to this network. And we're called Agile Nurses here in Norfolk, but I think they've got different names in different parts of the country. But essentially we're agile because we're supposed to be able to drop into whatever setting is engaging with research at this time, whether it's care homes, prisons, schools, whatever.
I was just thinking when you said the word nurse, what do you have to be a certain type of person to work in research?
No, that's a really good point. And I should clarify that you don't have to be a nurse. So you can get, I think they're called clinical research practitioners, who don't necessarily have a specific healthcare profession. So I think if you've been a healthcare assistant or assistant practitioner, but you're interested in research, and I don't think you even necessarily need to have come from a healthcare background, but you can get a research practitioner, so individual training which leads you to be an expert in the delivery of research. But you get research occupational therapists, physiotherapists. It's really useful to have a kind of a blended team, which is what we've got at NCHNC, because there are all sorts of studies which require different expertise to deliver. The NIHR has lots of opportunities for getting involved in research, and this is both for patients and practitioners. So if you're a patient, you can both be a participant in a research project, but you can also join some of the panels that review the initial applications. So if I want to do a bit of research and I need to get some funding to do so, I have to write an application, and they need both professionals and lay people to look at these applications and say, yeah, that looks like a valuable bit of research, or I'm a patient with that condition and they have totally missed the point. That is no good at all. So from reviewing the applications to sitting on the kind of boards, which then discuss this and work out who's going to get the funding, there's lots of opportunities for patients to get involved, but also practitioners. So if you've got a research idea, if you're not interested, you don't have to be the person who turns that into a research project, carries it through and delivers it. You can go to the NIHR Research Delivery Service, RDS. You can go onto the NIHR website and access all of this, and they can have a look at that for you. They can see if, you know, it might be that there has been some research done, but you're a busy practicing clinician, you haven't had time to do a literature search and check it all out, but you've noticed something that's a gap in our service. Take it to the RDS, they might find some research, and then, you know, to some extent that's answered your problem. I'm in the, oh great, someone's done this research, I wasn't aware of it, but look at this. Or there might not have been that research done there, and they can put you in touch with a research group that is working in that field, who might then take that idea forwards and try and work it up into a project and get funding to deliver the research that answers that question. But then need to find out, you know, what capacity do you have if you do want to do this study? You know, what support will you need to do that? And putting in as much or as little as is needed to make it as easy as possible for them to get research active. Within the Trust, the community research team would love to hear from anyone and everyone who's got any interest in getting research going in their area, in their clinical specialism. So if you don't have any research going on and it's something that you're interested in, do reach out, let the community team know, and they can keep their eye out for studies in your specialism. And then when stuff comes up, they can just say, you know, what do you think of this? How about it?
Thank you for listening to Take a Moment with NCHC. If you've enjoyed this podcast, please visit the podcast intranet page to leave a comment and for details of our other episodes. You can also follow NCHC on all social media channels.